From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Last week, a public radio producer named Rachel Ward and her colleagues at WXXI in Rochester started to record testimonials from people all around the city.
My name is Michael Spatolnik. I've lived in Rochester since 1959. Before that, I was raised in Hornell, New York.
And what brought you up to Rochester?
Kodak.
Right at the center of Rochester's skyline, a majestic building still dominates. The word Kodak still shines brightly from the top. It's George Eastman's legacy right there in brick and mortar. And yet today, Kodak is barely a shadow of its former self. Last week, it filed for bankruptcy protection. A company that in 1982 employed more than 60,000 people in Rochester has fewer than 7,000 workers today. The company basically invented digital photography, but it couldn't figure out how to make the transition from film quickly enough to outcompete its Asian rivals. And today, of the 10 best-selling digital cameras in the U.S., not a single Kodak. Now, just 3 years ago, two other iconic American brands, GM and Chrysler, were also on the ropes. Not anymore. And that's our cover story today, making things in America and saving the American brand. But first, more memories from Rochester.
When we were young and not so well off, Kodak was our place for recreation. We went there for bowling, for dining. They helped subsidize my education.
Yeah, I met my wife there. And I worked way in the back, and I had to walk through the production areas to get to the cafeteria. And every day I'd walk by and...
He was this cute guy. He'd walk by with a coffee, and one day he came by and said hi and asked me to go get a cup of tea, and that's how we started talking.
Been together 32 years.
Girl from Kodak Town.
We're here to talk about memories, and Kodak was, you know, it was just the thing. My dad loved softball.
Did he play softball with Kodak?
Oh, yeah.
What position did he play?
He was an outfielder. He used to try to teach me a special way of catching a ball, and I still can't do it today. And this, the old Willie Mays basket catch in front, he thought that was the best way to catch a ball. But Kodak meant so much to everybody here. I mean, we did everything around Kodak. I look at her and I say, well, General Motors, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, was in bankruptcy. Chapter 11, and they're out, and now they just understand that they're one of the strongest companies in the world now, back to being number one in autos. We can turn this around. We just got to come up with some better ways of doing things.
There's still good people at Kodak. It's always just been associated with quality and quality products, and who knows, maybe it'll never be the company that it was, but it still may become a viable company.
That's Rochester resident Michael Spatolnik. We also heard from Larry Arnone and from Bill James and his wife Katie. And that point that Larry made about GM, that was the centerpiece of President Obama's State of the Union speech on Tuesday.
We bet on American workers. We bet on American ingenuity. And tonight, the American auto industry is back.
Now, just 2 years ago, many people in this country and around the world assumed that the age of the American car manufacturer was over. And yet, when you come here to the Washington Auto Show, which opened this weekend, what's clear is how confident American automakers have become. There are hundreds of new models all across the showroom floor, and they're innovative cars in terms of their design and their prices. And probably one of the best slogans is Chrysler's. There's a huge sign above its newest sedan, and it reads, "Imported from Detroit." This month, GM and Chrysler are expected to post their best results since the start of the crisis. On Friday, Ford posted its biggest profit since 2009. And no one at the auto show sounded more confident about American manufacturing than Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood.
When I was here 3 years ago, and when I was in Detroit 3 years ago, it was like being at a funeral. Detroit this year was like being at a wedding, one of the best celebrations I've ever been at. The automobile industry is back, and it's back because President Obama decided he was going to make an investment. He was going to invest taxpayer dollars and very skilled workers, and GM and Chrysler are back. Chrysler's paid all the money back. And GM's paid almost all of it back.
Do you think those companies, particularly GM, had to kind of hit rock bottom, you know, in order to get to the
Look,
point?
Look, I'm a forward-looking person. What I'm saying is GM is back. It's a great American story. It really is.
But how? How did American auto companies bounce back? And what can other American companies learn from that story?
Well, it's an extraordinary story. Summer of 2008, it was shocking to realize how much trouble GM really was in.
That's Bill Vlasic. He's the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. Think back to 2008, he says. GM, once the largest private sector employer in the country, was on the path to insolvency by the end of the year. No bank would lend GM money, so the Obama administration insisted the company declare bankruptcy, and with a giant federal bailout, they began a massive overhaul.
It was interesting that the leadership of General Motors had resisted Chapter 11, saying that people wouldn't buy a car from a bankrupt car company. Well, that was proven wrong. But more importantly, for the longest time, it was considered, well, we can't lose Pontiac, this storied brand with all this history that people care about. Guess what? When they closed the division, nobody cared.
Same with Saturn, right?
Same with Saturn. They resisted giving this up, but once they did, the company became more streamlined, more focused. Like they say, nothing focuses the mind like the noose. There's a humility there now that perhaps wasn't there before. That being said, did the American taxpayer get a good deal? Was it worth it? The estimates of the number of jobs that would have been lost in this country if GM had been allowed uncontrolled bankruptcy are in the hundreds of thousands. You know, are these saving these jobs in the communities and the manufacturing base worth $10 or $15 or $20 billion it'll ultimately end up costing? I think that's for your listeners to judge.
Humility, restructuring, tough decisions, and billions of government dollars to fall back on. It was enough to save American automakers, but what about smaller companies like Kodak and Rochester? Bill Vlasic says only one thing is certain. Kodak will come out of its bankruptcy a different kind of company.
They can't expect sentiment to save them. It has to be based on their ability to compete with not just companies around the world, but companies here in the United States, and whether or not they can tap into their sort of historical ingenuity and success and come up with the kind of products that can get them back on track.
Then there's the question of why it matters whether these iconic American brands survive or whether there's a good economic reason to make things in this country. Why does it matter whether our cameras or cars are made here? I put that question to Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan.
I mean, if we want, as a nation, if we decide that we don't want to make things, you'd have to deal with the huge fallout, the massive job loss that would have ensued. But you would also have to deal with the consequence of a country that doesn't make anything. If we rely on other countries to build the stuff that we use, then we are completely at the mercy of others. If you want to have a strong country, you have to make things.
Jennifer Granholm, you may have seen some stories in the New York Times recently about why the iPod and the iPad were not being built in the United States. They're designed here, they're not built here. And one of the arguments raised was not because American workers are necessarily less efficient than Chinese workers, but simply because if you've got a factory in Shenzhen, China, and you need a part, you just go down to the factory next door and they can manufacture the part for you within hours.
Exactly right, because China has decided to get aggressive on attracting job providers. What we have done in the United States is we've decided that economic strategizing or planning or offering assistance to businesses to locate here is not what we do. This blind fealty to laissez-faire, hands-off economics might be nice in theory, but it no longer applies in a global economy when our economic competitors are not playing by the same rules. We cannot bring a knife to a gunfight, and that's exactly what we've done.
Have we missed the train, though? I mean, is there a way to revive manufacturing in America, or is that story pretty much over?
Absolutely not. We will not get back the investments that have been made by companies overseas because it's too expensive to bring those investments back. But we do have an incredibly innovative country. Products are being made all the time, and decisions are being made even as we speak right now by CEOs of manufacturing firms about where to locate. I think advanced manufacturing we can be competitive in. The lower skilled manufacturing with repetitive motion, we probably won't get that. But advanced manufacturing, you better believe we can do it.
I guess you would argue the best evidence for that is the auto industry. I mean, they are making a product that Americans are buying.
Amen, brother. The auto industry has been saved because there was a smart, strategic, active partnership with the federal government. Those who are running against President Obama would have let the industry die. That would have made us a weak nation. It would have been terrible strategy. We would have lost the manufacturing backbone, and that philosophy will harm our nation.
That's Jennifer Granholm. She's the former governor of Michigan. We also heard from Bill Vlasic of the New York Times. His book about the 2008 auto bailouts is called Once Upon a Car. Thanks to the production staff at member station WXXI in Rochester, New York, for helping us tell the story of Kodak. By the way, we should point out Rochester, in a lot of ways, the city's doing great. Despite Kodak's bankruptcy, the University of Rochester is now the largest employer in town, and its medical research center is growing very quickly. There's even a budding music scene, including the music we've been hearing. It's by Rochester-based band Giant Panda Gorilla Dub Squad. This track is called Sunshine. I'm swimming through your borders. I'll be swaying through yours. One morning, many years ago, a little boy in Brooklyn named Peter woke up to an amazing sight. Fresh snow.
After breakfast, he put on his snowsuit and ran outside. The snow was piled up very high along the street to make a path for walking.
That's Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton reading from the groundbreaking book The Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats.
Crunch, crunch, crunch. His feet sank into the snow. He walked with his toes pointing out, like this. He walked with his toes pointing in, like that. Then he dragged his feet slowly to make tracks. And he found something sticking out of the snow that made a new track. It was a stick. A stick that was just right for smacking a snow-covered tree.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Snowy Day, which, when it came out in 1962, was the first major kids' book to feature a black protagonist who wasn't a caricature. Ezra Jack Keats won the Caldecott Medal for his work, the highest award for a children's picture book.
Well, the first page is the hook. It grabs the reader. There's a beautiful two-page spread of Peter in his pajamas looking out his window from his bed into the snow. The city is covered with snow.
That's Deborah Pope. She's the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation. And as she explains, the book brings to life a magical moment some children get to experience.
When you realize, one, you don't have to go to school, and two, you get to play in this world that is all yours. It's all yours. The snow is there just for you. And you can see that. You can see that expression in Peter's face.
The one thing that is never mentioned in the text, Deborah, it just doesn't seem like it's a big deal at all, but in fact it was at the time, is that Peter, this boy Peter, is African-American.
Yep. Yep.
Why wasn't it ever mentioned?
Because it wasn't important. It wasn't the point. The point was that this is a beautiful book about a child's encounter with snow and the wonder of it, and the difficulties, the being rejected by older kids, the realization that snow doesn't last, it's not forever. This is not about color. This is about childhood.
He thought it would be fun to join the big boys in their snowball fight, but he knew he wasn't old enough, not yet. So he made a smiling snowman, and he made angels. He pretended he was a mountain climber. He climbed up a great big tall heaping mountain of snow and slid all the way down.
This is a visually beautiful book. It's very simple. The art is very simple. It's collage-like. Peter is obviously central in this book. There are all these images that are now iconic. You know, Peter in this red costume, his brown skin against the white snow. Was was Ezra Jack Keats trying to make a statement? Was he consciously trying to make a statement when he wrote this book and made Peter an African-American?
This book, it's hard to answer that question because part of the answer would be yes, and part of the answer would be no. Yes, because he said, well, all the books he had ever illustrated, there had never been a child of color, and they're out there. They should be in the books, too. And so he wanted to put a child of color into his book. But was he trying to make a cause book? Was he trying to make a point? No, he wasn't. He was writing a book about a child. Some of the criticism that he received had to do with the fact that he didn't mention that this was a child of color.
I mean, at the time, this was 1962. This was quite controversial. Some African Americans, like Langston Hughes, praised Ezra Jack Keats, sent him a letter praising the book.
Yes.
But others, civil rights activists and others, felt that this book didn't go far enough.
They were worried. This was, as you pointed out, it was a tumultuous time. It was a time in which the African-American community was fighting for its place at the table, was fighting to be heard. And here we have this book. And in the past, when white authors had written about black characters, it had not done well. It was not good. It wasn't good. And so their reaction was, I believe, defensive. And then they realized, because of the way it was embraced, because the reaction that teachers and parents and children, because of their positive experience and reaction to the book, was overwhelming, the criticism subsided. It was no longer necessary that the book say, I am an African-American child going out into the snow today. They realized you don't put a color on a child's experience of the snow.
He picked up a handful of snow, and another, and still another. He packed it round and firm and put the snowball in his pocket for tomorrow. Then he went into his warm house. He told his mother all about his adventures while she took off his wet socks. And he thought and thought and thought about them.
This character, Peter, is inspired by a real person, right?
It's inspired by an image that he cut out of Life magazine in the early 1940s, a strip of four photographs of a little boy, an African-American boy, who has been chosen to receive an experimental vaccine in Georgia. And this kid is like a little dollop of sunshine. In the first frame, he's just beaming out at the camera. He's so happy. He's been chosen. He's going to be given something special. He's a little boy. In the second frame, he's beginning to offer his arm. He wants to know, well, is this going to hurt? And the third, he's really got his arm out, and he gets the vaccine. And in the last frame, he's so hurt. He's pulled his arm back in to him, to his chest, and he's looking out at the camera with such quizzical pain. How could you have hurt me? And Ezra, didn't know why this series of pictures moved him, but he cut it out. He kept it with him for 20 years. And when he was given the chance to make a book of his own, that's when he realized why he had chosen to keep this picture with him for so many years. It was this child who entered the world with such joy and had to deal with the pain that very often comes.
Of course, this book went on to win the coveted Caldecott medal. How did children react to this book?
Well, children embraced this book. Kids who grew up in Iowa or in Florida, kids who never see snow. And so Ezra got tons of mail from kids with pictures of Peter, of the snowman, of the snow angels. And perhaps most movingly, there was a teacher wrote into Ezra saying, the kids in my class, for the first time, are using brown crayons to draw themselves. These are African-American children. Before this, they drew themselves with pink crayons, but now they can see themselves.
That's Deborah Pope. She's the executive director of the Ezra Jack Keats Foundation and a childhood friend of the late author himself. You can see some of the illustrations from The Snowy Day and hear the rest of LeVar Burton's reading at our website, npr.org.
While he slept, he dreamed that the sun had melted all the snow away. But when he woke up, his dream was gone. The snow was still everywhere. New snow was falling. After breakfast, he called to his friend from across the hall, and together they went out into the deep, deep snow.
And for Saturday, that's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Check out our podcast. It's also called Weekends and All Things Considered. You can find it at npr.org/weekendatc or on iTunes. We post a new episode Sunday nights. For more on the show and upcoming interviews, you can find it on Twitter at NPR Guy Raz or at NPRWATC. We're back on the radio tomorrow with more news, stories, music, and more. Until then, thanks for listening and have a great night.
Hazel and Augustus have what they call a cute meet in the movies, but improbable, ludicrous, and fateful, too. Hazel is 16 and has thyroid cancer, with what they call a satellite in the lungs that keeps filling her with sour stuff that makes her feel like she's drowning. Augustus, or Gus, is a little older, lithe and handsome. He's lost a quarter of a leg to cancer, but tells people, "I'm on a roller coaster that only goes up." They meet in a support group for young cancer patients that's held in a church basement. Two smart, funny, doomed young people in Indianapolis who find support groups a pompous bore, but they're sure glad to find each other. The Fault in Our Stars is the title of John Green's new book for young adults. Mr. Green joins us from Albuquerque, member station KANW. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's really a pleasure to be here.
What first came to mind? The story of what cancer patients, young cancer patients in particular, go through, or the characters, these two kids?
The characters came to me first. I worked as a student chaplain at a children's hospital about 12 years ago for 5 months. And during that time, I started wanting to write about these kinds of young people. And it just took a while.
Let's get right to the reading and the way the book opens, which is in the support group.
Late in the winter of my 17th year, my mother decided I was depressed, presumably because I rarely left the house, spent quite a lot of time in bed, read the same book over and over, ate infrequently, and devoted quite a bit of my abundant free time to thinking about death. Whenever you read a cancer booklet or website or whatever, they always list depression among the side effects of cancer. But in fact, depression is not a side effect of cancer. Depression is a side effect of dying. Cancer is also a side effect of dying. Almost everything is, really. But my mom believed I required treatment, so she took me to see my regular doctor, Jim, who agreed that I was veritably swimming in a paralyzing and totally clinical depression, and that therefore my meds should be adjusted, and also that I should attend a weekly support group. This support group featured a rotating cast of characters in various states of tumor-driven unwellness. Why did the cast rotate? A side effect of dying.
Boy, you put your finger on it. Doctors say, you're depressed, we ought to do something about that. But the one thing cancer patients probably are not encouraged to say is, yes, I'm depressed. Unlike you, I have cancer.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's one of those things that's easy for those of us who are well to say. I mean, later in the book, someone notes that Shakespeare quote that the title comes from, Cassius saying to Brutus, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, which is easy to say, you know, when you're Shakespeare.
You introduce the reader to what the kids in the book called cancer perks.
Yeah. You know, when you're a young person with cancer, you get things sometimes, you know, signed balls by your favorite basketball team, or in Gus's case, a driver's license, even though he's not a very good driver. And they're conscious of all the side effects of their disease and the weirdness of their lives, because they're very conscious of the fact that other people look at them differently. Both Hazel and Gus are unusually empathetic for teenagers, and that was important to me. I wanted them to be aware of the world around them in a way that, you know, some teenagers aren't.
Help us understand their sense of humor.
Well, all the people I've known who were sick, young or old, were still funny. It's important to note or remember that, you know, people who are sick and people who are dying aren't dead. They're still alive. And sometimes we forget that, and we treat the sick and the dying so gingerly and so carefully, when often what they most want is to be alive while they are alive. And so I've known a lot of young people who were very sick, but also very, very funny, and often in dark, dark ways.
You've got a wonderful phrase for it. One of your characters says you take your humor where you can get it.
Yeah.
When the love story between Hazel and Gus begins, Hazel is worse off. And I don't want to violate any plot points, but at some point they switch places. Was it important for you for people to understand the kind of capriciousness of health?
Yeah, I think cancer in many ways to those of us alive today is similar to what tuberculosis was like in the 19th century. It's so unfair. It takes the young. It takes the old. Sometimes you live, sometimes you die, and it's very difficult to make sense of the reasons why it may go one way or another. It's very, very difficult to imagine it as anything other than just cruel and cold and capricious. And that makes it difficult to imagine the universe as anything other than cold and capricious. And I wanted to be honest about that because I wanted them to have to face, you know, in the most desperate way, that overwhelming question, as T.S. Eliot called it, of how we're going to organize our lives and what they're going to mean.
Do your young readers, do they lack a depth of knowledge of what makes this story resonant that, you know, that actual parents might have?
I do think that parents read the novel differently, inevitably, because they know that the secret to all relationships with your children is that as long as either of you is alive, you will be that person's parent, and that person will be your child.
You've got a line in there that's a real bolt to the heart, where you say there's only one thing worse than being a kid with cancer.
Yeah, and that's having a kid with cancer. And that's something that a kid said to me when I worked at the hospital all those years ago that really stuck with me. It stuck with me partly because it's unusual that children are able to imagine their parents complexly enough to understand how difficult it is. Mm-hmm. And also because I knew how much neither the parent nor the child wanted that to be true, even though it was true.
And I have to ask, you're in the middle of your publicity tour, right?
Yeah.
Are there youngsters that are challenged the way your characters are that come up to you?
There have been, yeah. I mean, I've been really lucky to meet and talk with young people who are dealing with cancer and living with cancer.
Anything you can share?
I'm worried I'll cry if I share anything. Yeah. But I just talked yesterday to a young woman who I've known for a long time who has muscular dystrophy, and she told me that she'd highlighted passages that she identified with so that she could show her friends the book as a way of expressing to them things that she feels like she can't say out loud. Mm-hmm. And that was very important to me. That was very kind of her to say.
Mr. Green, you're not distant from your readers at all, are you?
No. I'm very fortunate. You know, I know them, and I like hearing from them. I feel fortunate to interact with them. I like reading their YouTube comments. I like reading their reviews on book review websites. And I like the engagement that we have with each other, because the truth is the world extends outside the world of books. And, you know, I feel fortunate to be able to have a relationship with them outside of the book as well as inside of it.
John Green, his new bestseller for young readers is The Fault in Our Stars. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
B. the artist best known for dripping and splattering paint across canvases, Jackson Pollock, was born 100 years ago on this date. And to mark the occasion, we headed down to the National Gallery of Art here in Washington to check out one of his most iconic paintings with the modern art curator there, Harry Cooper.
We are looking at a painting called Number One, and informally subtitled Lavender Mist.
Despite the fact there's no lavender or mist in it, there are violent stabs and drips of pastel colors, pinks and whites and aquamarines with black slashes circling it like a web. And Pollock's not just working with splattered paint here.
There's a lot of stuff on it, bits of cigarette and other things. We see some hand prints that Pollock very purposely placed in the upper corners and the upper edge.
Jackson Pollock's fame is based on this technique alone, but his career was much more varied than that. When he studied under Thomas Hart Benton, the American regionalist, Pollock's paintings were indistinguishable from Benton's, clear human forms with enhanced curves, as if windblown or carved like riverbeds. Now, over time, Pollock's forms would become more surreal, like Picasso's, but the trademark splatterwork didn't really make an appearance until Pollock was in his mid-30s.
He doesn't come to it really until 1947, and he dies in 56. So it's less than a decade, and in fact, by the end of 50 and 51, he's not doing the drips anymore.
But the splatterwork remains the focus of everyone's attention, even though it's always been divisive. From the very beginning, there were two camps, those who loved it and those who hated it.
He had some dealers behind him, important people like Peggy Guggenheim. But in the popular mind, he was Jack the Dripper. you know, my child could do this. I think all of those feelings and associations have remained with the work, no matter how many books and how many retrospectives he has.
Yet in 2006, one of Pollock's paintings sold for $140 million. That made it the most expensive painting ever sold. So why does this man, whose work is as derided as it is desired, why does he have this lasting popularity?
De Kooning said Jackson broke the ice. He put the canvas on the floor. He stopped using brushes in the normal way. Yes, there's a randomness to it, but there's also a great order to it as well. He is a colorist, arguably in a great tradition of romantic painting, evoking atmosphere.
Would you say he is one of, or among the five or six most important American artists?
One of the three or four, yeah, I would say.
That's Harry Cooper. He's the curator of modern and contemporary art at the National Gallery of Art here in Washington, D.C. They've got two Jackson Pollock pieces on display there. You can see them both at our website, npr.org.
It would be nice not to have orchestrated attacks that try to distort the history of that period.
Rhino Romney is the least electable.
Over-the-top rhetoric that's characterized American politics too long.
Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich from Thursday's debate and some of the super PAC ads that provoked them. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us now, as he does most Saturdays, for a look behind the headlines. Jim, hello.
Hello, Guy.
Jim, I want to get to some of the things we've been talking about on the program in a moment. But first, Thursday's debate. Of course, all eyes were on the Gingrich-Romney showdown. But there was a moment, slightly less noticed, I think. It was when Rick Santorum called Romney out on his health care plan when he was governor of Massachusetts.
Yes, I thought that if Mitt Romney goes ahead to become the nominee, which is what the odds have favored all the way along, I thought that exchange might prefigure something we're going to hear a lot more about in the summer and the fall. Because what Rick Santorum was able to do was to induce Mitt Romney to give a better, shorter definition of the need for an individual mandate in health care insurance than Barack Obama has ever done. Essentially, Governor Romney is saying, if you're going to care for people eventually in emergency rooms, you can't have them free riding on the system. So people either have to get covered or they have to pay to be exempted from the system, which is essentially the national plan known pejoratively as Obamacare by the Republicans. And it's what Governor Romney enacted in Massachusetts. And so squaring that inequation of why something was great in Massachusetts and, as Governor Romney pointed out, is still very popular with people there, but would be a terrible socialist menace for the country. I'm sure that this won't be the last time we hear of it.
Probably not. I want to ask you about this other issue, this anti-Newt Gingrich phenomenon. Recently, as you know, the conservative establishment has been circling the wagons against him, you know, from Bob Dole to John Sununu to opinion shapers in the conservative press. I mean, they are all on the attack against Newt Gingrich. What do you make of all that?
I think it is a real challenge to Newt Gingrich, and the two most problematic aspects of the attack being made against him by other people in the party are, number one, the people who know him best and have worked with him most closely, whether it's Tom DeLay or Bob Dole, say, we know this man and we don't like him and he'll be bad for the party. Second, there's an argument from a lot of the sort of viziers of the party saying that if you nominate Newt Gingrich, you reelect Barack Obama. Republican primary voters seem to feel that Newt Gingrich would be as electable as any other candidate, including Mitt Romney, but polls of the general electorate do not show that, and he trails Barack Obama badly.
Let me ask you finally, Jim, about the president's State of the Union address. We've been talking about American manufacturing on the program today. President Obama's tone was, America is back. You know, we are full steam ahead here. What did you make of that tone?
I thought the tone was probably the most significant aspect of this speech because of the positioning for the president in a reelection year. Over time, Americans may be angry, they may be dissatisfied, they may grumble, but finally, we like happy candidates. We like the happy, confident Ronald Reagan against Jimmy Carter in 1980 or Walter Mondale in 1984. We liked the happy, confident Bill Clinton in 1996 against the more acerbic Bob Dole. And so if the president can be the happy warrior this year and the Republicans are the more negative-sounding ones, that puts him just in a better position.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Guy.